I'd like to tell you that I feel very honored to be numbered among you as Latter-day Saints. I don't think, in fact, I know that there's no title in the world that I would prefer having than that of Mormon or Latter-day Saint. We have spent most of our adult life living in a world among non-Latter-day Saints, and most of our associations and our close friends for the last 20 years have been among non-Latter-day Saints, as I had just recently returned to Salt Lake, where I had spent the prior 20 years in the business world in the Midwest. But I'd like to tell you that living among the Latter-day Saints and living among the non-Latter-day Saints and having the principles that we have as Mormons has never, ever, ever caused the slightest embarrassment to me or the slightest difficulty. In fact, I have found it to be a thing of joy to be one that was slightly different among my friends, and even a thing of fun and delight in many instances. A few years ago, as an example, when the Howard Hughes will was such a popular thing, it was on the front page of all the newspapers in Minneapolis where I was living continually for several days, and it was in the New York Times and other places that we would read about it. The first day that the story broke that we had the will and that we were going to be the benefactors, a very close business associate of mine who happens to be a Jewish person who was also very wealthy, he had a business of his own that he sold and made several million dollars on it, he came storming into my office that day waving the newspaper and he calling me by my last name. He says, "Edgley," he says, "I don't need to know the doctrine. I don't want to know the theology. I don't even want to know the people. But I just want you to know I'm one of you. Count me in." And I retorted and said, "That's just fine, Jim. We'll be happy to have you. But I want you to know that you have to pay your dues first. And in your instance, it's not just on your income, but on your estate." And he backed off on that just a little bit. But we had fun all through the company, as a matter of fact. We had fun with that for several months as this thing was a prominent issue. And in fact, Jim at this time, I guess, had other alternative motives, but he used this little fun to clean up his life a little bit. And so he quit drinking, and he quit smoking, and he quit drinking coffee. And we would, on occasion, be at a business situation where they would be serving cocktails, and when somebody would find out that he wasn't drinking, I heard him on one occasion say, "No, I've joined up with Edgley and Howard Hughes, and if you know what's good for you, you'd put that cigar out." And then I was in another situation one time. We were in a business conference, there was probably 30 of us in Chicago, and it was time for a coffee break. And at that coffee break, they brought in soft drinks and rolls, as they normally do, and everything was going fine. And all of a sudden, I hear this shrill voice coming across the room and saying, "Hey, Edgley, do we drink Coke?" But it all ended. It all ended when it finally broke in the paper that we were not the benefactors of that will and that we were not going to be blessed with Howard Hughes' wealth. And he came storming into my office, this time with the headline, and says, "Count me out. I didn't trust you guys anyway. And besides, our guys are working on one right now, and it's going to be a lot better than the last one." So that's how that went. But let me tell you another situation, just kind of in fun. My first trip on a business trip to Paris was some time ago, and I was met there to meet with the management of our toy companies. And that night, we were going to go out to dinner, and I was going out to dinner with the president of this company, and I didn't know that he knew anything about me. That was my first trip over there. But he had planned to take us to his home for a little social hour and some cocktails before taking us to dinner. And we went to his home, and I was just ever so delighted and felt so pleased with his thoughtfulness, because he somehow found out I was a Mormon and I was a little bit different. And so he had arranged to have several fruit drinks there and all kinds of pop and soft drinks, and he was just so gracious to make sure that in no way would he offend me. And he went out of his way, and I can tell you that of those there, I had the greatest selection of what to drink of anybody there at the evening. And after we spent a gracious, pleasant hour in his home, we went out to one of the very, very fine restaurants in Paris, and he went through the ceremony of selecting the wine. And maybe some of you have been in this kind of a situation, but it is sometimes quite a ceremony, particularly to a Frenchman who thinks wine is the ultimate in life. And so the maitre d'or comes and he brings the bottle of wine, and you pull the cork off, and first you sniff it and pass it around to a few other people, and then you put it on a glass and swish it around and test it, and then you send him back. If you don't send him back five times, it just doesn't look right. And so you send him back, and he brings another bottle, and you go through this, and finally Michelle had selected the wine that was just right for the dinner we were having that night. And he goes through and begins to fill everybody's glasses. And he comes to my glass, and I just put my hand over it and say, "No, Michelle, I wouldn't care for any wine." And he stopped absolutely dead in his tracks. There was a silence that seemed like it was for a minute, although it was only a few moments. And he said, "But Dick, this is wine." And I said, "Yes, Michelle, I know it's wine. I really wouldn't care for any." And he said, "Not even wine?" And I said, "No, Michelle, I'll just have water, please." And then he thought for a moment and sat there in silence, and he said, "Dick, you must be the finest connoisseur of water in the world." And so I tell you that because it has always been fun, and it's always been delightful. And when anybody ever asked me where I was from when I lived out of this area, I always said, rather than telling them I lived in Idaho, I would say, "I come from just around Salt Lake City." And then the next question would be, "Are you a Mormon?" And right off, I was able to establish who I was and that I was a Latter-day Saint. And so I tell you that I am proud to be numbered among you. And I take great delight in being able to tell people that I am a Latter-day Saint and that I have certain principles and beliefs that I would like to live while respecting the beliefs and principles of others. Now, I'd also like to tell you that I don't consider myself an intellectual. I'm only one that has some simple beliefs and some values that I'd like to talk to you about. And I suspect that you'll have to get your intellectual stimulation next hour, and that's what your professors are paid for anyway. And what I would like to do is talk about some of these values and some of these principles from some personal experiences. I apologize if I rely too heavily on these personal experiences, but you might find some of them interesting. I was interested and I was touched in the last general conference by Elder Thomas E. Monson's talk. You may recall that he talked about some of the things that he had learned walking through a cemetery and reading headstones in the cemetery, and some of the lessons and messages that seemed to rise out from the dead in that cemetery. Last spring, I happened to be walking through a cemetery in southeastern Idaho, a small cemetery that I've been in dozens of times in the past. And in the midst of that cemetery is a statue, a monument that stands there, and although I've seen it many times, I had never taken the time to walk over and look at it and read the inscription on that. This last time I did, and I would like to read portions of it. I think I will not, I'll try not to read all of it, as a matter of fact, because the way time is slipping by, but maybe enough to get the message across. It says, "They figured he was a mama's boy, that tow-headed youth who recently came. They were thinking, of course, of Private Van Noy, the lad who could speak without being profane. But he wasn't a soldier. That is, you see, well, he had no stripes or medals or bars, but he fought like a true son of Mars. He had just joined the outfit a few days before, that quiet young blade of 19. Perhaps they thought he was green to the core because of his juvenile mien. Fact is, they took little note of the boy, but little they knew of Nathan Van Noy. Junior Van Noy, in spite of his youth, got a zero at Red Beach the very next day, and that to his comrades was plenty of proof. In his hammock that night, he gave glory and praise to the God in the downpour of rain. He dreamed, no doubt, of his high school days and slept in spite of his pain. But when the rain ceased and the blackness ere dawn, three smudges were seen offshore, and Junior was ready when word came along that the enemy were at it once more. He rolled from his hammock and he crawled to his pit. His loader was soon by his side. One barge was hit by the first gun to spit, and the enemy were dumped by the tide. An Aussie two-pounder gun landed the blow, which followed by two armor shells, and she sank to the coral below, and dawn was ringing with Japanese yells. The other two barges hove straight within reach. From their peaked prows they vomited ire. Then scores of grenades peppered down on the beach, but Private Van Noy held his fire. It was not until the ramps were down all the way and the enemy heard the bugle to charge that Private Van Noy gave the trigger full play and began pouring lead at the barge. His loader was soon crawling back from the field, his shattered leg trailing behind. We thought that Van Noy had no choice but to yield, but Van Noy was not of that mind. And Aussie brand gunners, so thorough and cool, were shouting for Whitey to run. "Get out of there, you bloody fool." But he was reloading his gun. It was just about then that a hand grenade fell in the spot where his loader had been. He staggered a little and gave a sharp yell, but still was determined to win. Then other guns flashed from the hulls of the barges and were answered by guns from the hill. The Yanks and the Aussies fired hundreds of charges, but Nathan Van Noy's gun was still. Then the infantry came in a mopping deploy, but when they got there, they knew that the lad they had figured was Mama's boy had refused to let the enemy through. 'Twas a sad lot of victors when they saw that his bullets were gone, for they knew that Van Noy, the tow-headed youth, with only one leg, carried on. Of the 39 enemy that attempted to land from the boats of the rising sun, more than 20 of them lay dead in the sand in front of Van Noy's Browning gun. And when the sun climbed from the Bismarck Sea and the mists were beginning to rise, his comrades buried young Private Van Noy, who was shot between the eyes. Van Noy was a Yank, and he wouldn't run. He was the only soldier to fall. When he died, Van Noy was his mother's son, but now he belongs to us all. And on that same monument is another epitaph that I'm not going to read, but of another young man, a Private Brostrom. Two young men just out of high school, both that gave their lives, and one from that small community, the Congressional Medal of Honor. I was touched when I read that, and I was moved, and I had to wonder what it takes to give one's full measure of life. And I knew that as I read that, that listed on that monument were my heroes, and I wondered where my heroes today were. I was interested to note last night as we read about that tragic airplane crash in Washington, that as they plucked out the six survivors, or attempted to pluck out the six survivors of the freezing river, that when the line was dropped to one, what was considered middle-aged man, he passed it five times to let the others out. And then when they came back for him, he was gone, somewhere sunk below the ice. And then I knew that there was a modern-day hero. today. I've been intrigued by the motives and the courage. I'm aware of the events that transpired during the Korean War, when there was a new phenomenon that we began to see as Americans. And that phenomenon was seen in a lack of aggressiveness by our own military people. We saw for the first time our people, our own soldiers, collaborating with the enemy. We saw no efforts, organized attempts to escape for the first war that had ever been held. There were instances when our soldiers in prison merely went over and laid down in a corner and died of nothing but give-up-itis. The military was concerned about that, and they wanted to understand, and so they sent in a team of psychologists to study this phenomenon that was headed by a man by the name of Major Myers. And after years of study, they came back with some conclusions. And those conclusions went something like that, like this, that those young men who did not have close family ties and did not have a strong sense of values were the ones who broke, who collaborated, and who gave up in the attempt. But still faithful and true were those people particularly tied to strong families and had value systems. All of you remember, I'm sure, the turmoil of the Vietnamese War, when still another phenomenon was seen, where we saw mass desertions, where we saw mass numbers of draft dodgers that we're still trying to reconcile ourselves with this day. We saw bombings and murderings in our own country, and they became commonplace. And to some Americans, they even became acceptable. The enemy, in some instances, became idolized. They became the hero, both here and abroad. And the maimed soldier that had given his life or his time or had spent 5 years in prison often came back not the hero, but the dupe, the one who had been sent over unknowingly. And our definition of a real hero began to be fuzzy, and it began to get lost in the quagmire of confusion of perhaps selfishness and blurred values. And what I would like to do for the rest of this time, as we think about heroes and we look for them and we wonder why they're not so visible and why perhaps we don't see them today, we don't see the Private Van Noys and others, I'd like to tell you what, in my judgment, is the definition of an honest hero, a definition that applies today as well as yesterday, and perhaps will apply forever. I'd like to clarify to you what my thought is of a hero, and I'd like to do that with some stories. A few years ago, when I was a bishop in the Boston area, a mother of a teenage girl came into my office one day and said, "Bishop, I'd like to show you something. Have you got a few moments?" And I invited her in, and we sat down, and she handed me about a 12 or 14 page paper. And she said, "Would you take the time to read this paper?" And I went through, and it started something like this, and it was by her teenage daughter, and I could immediately see it was a school paper. It started saying, "We have been discussing for these past many months the history of the United States, and particularly the history of the West. And in that discussion, we have talked about the Mormon Church. And I want you to know that I have been offended by the things that we have said and the way that we have attacked in my class my prophet, Joseph Smith." And then she went on and she said, "I would like to set for the record straight once and for all about who the Mormons are and who the prophet Joseph Smith is. And then she went through and she gave one of the most beautiful dissertations on Mormonism, the value system in Mormonism, who we are, who the prophet is, that I have ever read. And then she concluded and say it's such a something in effect, I tell you these things because they're right, they're accurate, and they're true, and I know it. And then I was most interested in reading the handwritten scribbling of the teacher at the bottom that said, oh, Sherry, forgive me. Thank you for setting the record straight. A plus plus. And I looked up and I could see the eyes watering on her mother. And I was having a little trouble with my tear ducts. But what I knew right then is in my midst, in my very own congregation, a teenage girl was my hero. That I had learned what a hero was that day. In that same ward, we had a young man by the name of Hugh. And he was in the eighth grade. And he was given a reading assignment to read a particular book, and he started reading it, and he felt like the language was offensive to him. And so he came back to his teacher and said, I can't read this book. It's offensive, and I don't like the language. And the teacher said to him, Hugh, you don't understand. This is required reading for the course, and you have to read it, or you're going to get a failing grade. And Hugh, only in the eighth grade, said, no, you don't understand. This book offends me, and I'm not going to read the book. And so she sent him to the principal, and the principal says, Hugh, you don't understand. This isn't our decision. This is a district decision. Everybody in the district must read this as required reading. And Hugh said, no, you don't understand. I'm not going to read the book, and I'm not taking a failing grade. And the interesting thing is that all of a sudden, everybody in the little community of Linfield, of about 15,000, knew that Hugh was taking on the school board. And you could pick up literally every week when the weekly newspaper came out, on the front page would be the battle between Hugh and the school board. And what happened is the student body kind of got on, members got on Hugh and said, Hugh, you're being a little close on that, aren't you? Why don't you just give in? What kind of a sense of values is it? Are you all that much better than us that we can read it, but it's offensive to you? But the other interesting thing is about half the student body said, we think Hugh was right. If it's offensive to him, he shouldn't have to read that book. And besides that, come to think about it, it's offensive to me. And so the school began to divide. And the upshot of that is when we were all through, the book was taken off the required reading course in that district. And Hugh got his grade. And I knew that in an eighth grade boy, I had seen a true hero for the day. And so I would like to say that maybe the first element of a hero is being able to have the courage to stand up for principle and for values. A second thing that I would like to indicate is just simple, honest integrity. Honesty, being able to be trusted, being able to say something and knowing that it is being accepted for face value because you are trusted and you are honest. Let me tell you another little kind of fun experience. I was walking through an airport in O'Hare Airport in Chicago with several business people a few years ago, and my same little Jewish friend was with us, and he walked up to a newspaper stand, and he put a quarter in to get the newspaper, And he started passing out lots of newspapers off one quarter. He'd given us all a newspaper, and he didn't need to do that. He could have bought the airport, but he thought this was kind of fun. And he handed me a newspaper, and I just took a quarter out of my pocket and just walked over to the stand, and I put it in, and I turned to Jim in a little bit fun, but so he might understand. I said, "Jim, for a quarter, I'm not giving up my character." And then so, to give a little lightness, I said, "For a dollar maybe, Jim, but not for a quarter." And we walked off, and then we came back, and we were coming back to the same place, and I noticed Jim had slipped by, and he had a handful of quarters, and he was putting back into that machine. Now, that's true. That absolutely happened. And he thought about that a little bit, and he got the message in kind of a quiet, simple way. As Carl G. Mazur was sent down by Brigham Young to establish the university, he called his students together to explain the honor system. And he said, "Let me tell you what honor is to me." He said, "Build me a prison with walls ever so high and foundations ever so low, and put me in that prison. Can I escape? Maybe. I will die trying. But put me in a hall such as this and draw a chalk line around me and put me on my word of honor that I'll not cross that line. Now can I escape? No, never. I would die before I would cross that line." And so a simple, honest integrity, honesty to be trusted, to be known that you'll carry out in a reliable way the things that you have said. For a third point or characteristic of an honest hero, let me demonstrate by another personal story, if you will. Several years ago, again in the Boston area while I was a bishop, I was sitting at my office one day and my secretary buzzed me and said, "There is a Catholic priest on the telephone. Will you talk to him?" And I immediately responded that I would. As I lifted the phone, I heard this voice come through saying, "Father Edgley." And I immediately began to gloat in the new one title that I had. Not even my children call me Father all the time. And I said, "Yes, this is Bishop Edgley." And he said, "Yes, I have one here in my office with me, and I believe he is one of yours. Maybe you ought to come and see him." And he gave me his name, and his name was Les. And I immediately recognized who Les was because I had never met him. I had not been in the ward all that long, but I knew all about him. I knew, for instance, that several years ago his mother had been excommunicated from the church for prostitution. I knew that his father and his older brother had been excommunicated from the church and sent to prison for peddling drugs. And I also knew that there was a Les somewhere in this world and also a sister about his age, and we had never been able to locate them. So I was anxious to run over and see Les, and I left the office and drove over and found the parish and walked in and immediately found the office of the priest, and he came out to greet me. And he brought me to the office, and as I entered, I saw Les for the first time. And I have to confess that all of a sudden, I wondered what being a bishop was all about. I saw standing before me was this young man, I think was young, with hair all the way down to here. It was scraggly, dirty, filthy clothes. I could smell the stench as I entered the room. And I mumbled something to myself like, "Lord, you didn't tell me this was in the job description." And I went over and I talked to him for a few moments, and I found that he was almost incoherent. I didn't know whether it was because he was spaced out on drugs or because he was mentally retarded, but we were able to carry on a little bit of a conversation. And I asked him where he lived, and I went and I bought him a hamburger and took him to his to the place he lived, and it was a flop house. And we literally had to walk over the people that were passed out in order to get him to his room. I got him there, and I asked him, I said, Les, do you have any clean clothes? And he showed me some things hanging on the bed that looked cleaner. They weren't any better. They were rags, but they looked cleaner. And then I asked him if there was a shower in this building. And he walked me down to where there was a community shower, and I wondered whether he would get clean or whether he'd become more contaminated by just going in there. And I kept thinking, boy, nobody told me about this when they asked me to be a bishop. But I said to Les, now, I'm going to come back Sunday morning. Sunday morning, you go down to that shower and get yourself as clean as you can, and you get into these clothes, and I'm going to take you to priesthood meeting in church. And I wasn't looking forward to that. I even debated. I even wondered, who could I really give that job to? And I decided that if the bishop can't do it, nobody ought to have to do it. It went something like that. And then I came Sunday morning, I picked up Les, and I found him just about the way I left him. And so we cleaned him up a little bit and got him ready. And I brought him to church, and I had a meeting before a priesthood, and I set him down on a chair just outside of the door and said, Les, I'll be out in 15 minutes. You just sit here and wait. And while I was in that meeting, my good counselor, a man almost twice my age at the time, and who did not recognize Les, but who had known him as a very young man, came up to him and asked who he was. And he identified himself. And then Les said something to the effect, I'm hungry. And then my good counselor said something to the effect, good grief, what are you doing sitting here outside of a bishop's office if you're hungry? Come with me. And he took Les home into his beautiful home, and he fed him breakfast, and he went down and got some of his son's own clothes and dressed him. He missed priesthood altogether and came back and brought him to Sunday school. And then after Sunday school, he took Les home again and gave him dinner and fed him and visited with him and made him comfortable. And then he brought him back to sacrament meeting. And then he took him home again and fed him and got him some more clothes. And then he took him to Les's home. And all of a sudden, as I saw that, there became a great shame that came over me for tumbling down were the words that you can guess that came ever so clear. I was hungered and you gave me meat. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was naked and you clothed me. Wherein did I do those things? Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. And I felt that I had closed the door on the Savior that day. And I felt like I learned a very great lesson. I learned what the Savior meant when he was talking about one of the least of these things. And then I looked at my good counselor, and I knew that in our bishopric, we had a real hero for today, one that I could learn from, and one that I could follow and try to emulate. Now, I would like to tell you, my brothers and sisters, that there are heroes around. They can be found. They're here. They're even in our midst. Where do we find them? We find them on the battlefield, yes. We find the Private Van Noys. And we find the middle-aged men that'll pass the life-saving rope from one to the other until everyone is saved but himself. But we find them on the campuses of Snow College. We find them in our homes. We find them where we are willing to live simple, basic principles consistently, day after day. You're the clay, and you're also the sculpture. The simple, honest hero that you mold will be the product of your very own hands. And I would like to pray for you and for me that when that time comes that they lay us in that earth, that some interesting wanderer through a cemetery might look upon our tombstone and simply see the epitaph, an honest hero. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.